Thanks for downloading the Overdrive podcast. If you're on Instagram, make sure you follow us at TSN1050. If you're not, sign up and follow us, even if it's the only account that you follow. Because if you're a big fan of the show, you've got to know what's going on behind the scenes. On Instagram, at TSN1050.
It's Mail It In Friday.
I called in sick. I don't work in the rain.
Well, I kind of mailed that in.
You can't deliver mail?
Why not?
Yeah, whatever.
I guess you're right. It's just walking around putting it into boxes.
This is Overdrive on TSN 1050, the official voice of the Leafs.
Hour number two of Overdrive. St. Paddy's Day tomorrow. Scott MacArthur for Brian Hayes, who I think is on his way to Pittsburgh for a batch party. Craig Button is here for Jamie Noodles McLennan, who's got a hockey game to do. Jonas Siegel for Jeff O'Dog O'Neill, who's enjoying March break, and we'll be back on Monday.
How do you know who we're replacing?
I just go by where you're sitting.
Oh.
So Craig is in Noodle's seat.
Yeah, and I got the worst seat.
Yeah, O'Dog.
The middle seat. He does not like this seat.
No.
I understand it.
But he's from the hockey culture, right? He's deferring to the veteran, because he'll always say Noodles, because Noodles and Hayes were on Leafs lunch before O jumped in.
Right.
And so because Noodles has the veteran...
Because when I come on with Jeff, he goes into Noodles' spot.
Because he's the veteran. He's got tenure.
Okay.
Right? You respect the hierarchy or the pecking order, however you look at it. There you go.
It's fair.
Yeah? You'll learn something new every day.
You know what? I want more rebellion. Sit where you want.
Really? Just chaos?
I didn't say chaos. I said rebellion. There can be organized rebellion. It doesn't have to be chaotic.
So really? You think next time I do the show with Jeff, I just should sit in his seat?
Yeah.
And then what happens?
I don't know. We'll see.
How do you think Hazy would react?
You don't know. When you want to rebel and you want to have a rebellion, you don't know. I can't tell you what the outcome is.
He doesn't seem like the one I should do something like that to. Jamie, I think I can get away with it.
How do you think Hazy would react if you got in here first on a day you were doing Overdrive at like 3:55? He was out there in the green room visiting with somebody or whatever, and he walks in the door to this studio, and you have plopped yourself in the seat that I'm currently sitting in, which is where Brian usually sits.
He would just say, move.
And I don't think Jeff would say that. I think Jeff would silently stew.
No, come on. Jeff?
Yeah.
I think Jeff would lose it.
I don't think he would.
Should we try it next time?
I think that he would look at it and kind of go, he'd be one of these. Like, and then he'd be thinking, okay, what's happening here?
I think he would be more volatile.
It's an experiment that might be worthy of playing out.
You know what? It might be worth a poll to the Overdrive 1050 account. Should Jonas try to steal O-Dog's seat the next time they're on Overdrive together? Yes or no? Keep it simple, stupid. A simple yes or no. I don't think O would freak out. I think he would plot your demise. He'd get you back at a later date.
I don't think you guys are right. I'm not going to do it. It's not nice.
I don't want to find out.
He's earned his spot.
Okay. All right. So, you're going to defer to the hierarchy?
Yeah, like Jeff's that. Listening, I hope you heard that.
There you go. Deep down, Jonas loves you and respects you.
I think if he wears his Toronto Maple Leafs alumni blazer, that you always defer to him. But if he's not wearing it, I think... Speaking of things that he loves that alumni blazer.
My favorite is the Austin Matthews jersey, which he
interviewing Austin Matthews.
Well, that's awesome.
Well,
hey Jonas, he's not playing straight up beat reporter here.
That's true.
He is. He's got the tattoo, man. He is a diehard Leafs fan.
Oh, he's a Leafs fan. I mean, don't you love the stories when he was playing for Carolina? And he would come back here for the playoffs, and he would go into the crowd and cheer for the Leafs. Like, I mean, he grew up a Leafs fan, and it never left him.
I wonder, I mean, it would have crushed him not to make the cup final in 0-2. But I wonder what he was really thinking heading into that series. I mean, we want to win. I want to win. I want to compete for the Stanley Cup. But if I have to lose in the Eastern Conference Final, I'm glad it would be to the Maple Leafs as opposed to any other opponent.
Well, because then he could cheer for them in the cup final? Yeah.
Yeah, he'd be
There's
in the
no
city.
Lose.
Be back home. He'd be... I'm telling you, man, if It's probably an obvious comment, but if the Leafs make a Stanley Cup final at some point in the next 3 or 4 years, it should just be declared a municipal holiday for a week to 10 days. Only essential services should be forced to work, and honestly, sports media guys, because we'll have to be talking about it.
I don't agree. I think what makes the whole thing the crescendo of the is the anticipation. You got to go to work, and you got to get through lunch, and you got to get things done. And at the same time, you got this wild imagination going on what the game's going to feel like. You're talking with your work friends and your colleagues, and you're, what about this? What about that? They lose, you come into work the next day. They win, you come into work. One of the great things that I found in the early 2000s is getting on the subway or the trolley cars after a Leafs game in the playoffs. And the mood was, if you'd come into the city and you didn't know if they'd won or lost, all you had to do was get on a trolley car or subway and you knew. And the excitement of winning and the disappointment of losing, that's what it's all about. You can't just give a free pass and say nothing's going on, essential services. You need that interaction.
You need the water cooler talk.
You do. Come on. That's what. That's all part of the passion.
Yeah, well, I get it. I mean, Ray is a diehard Boston Red Sox fan, so I don't know if there's a hockey example for him, but we'll bring him on here. And Ray's appearance on Overdrive, as always, is brought to you by Valiant Financial. Ray, on the day of a big Boston Red Sox game, say it's a big game in the ALCS, World Series potential clincher, because you've experienced those now. What's that day like for you leading up to the game?
No, I can't wait for it to get started. I generally, if the Yankees aren't playing in the game, I call my brother to make sure that I tease him that his Yankees aren't in it. That definitely is part of the equation. I call a couple of Blue Jay buddies that love their Blue Jays and make sure they know that my team's in and theirs isn't. And then I make sure that I clear about 15 minutes at the start of the game so I can organize whatever mess needs to be cleaned up around the house. And then I can settle down into my spot to watch the game.
Okay, so Game 7, 2004. Take us back to that day.
Yankees, Red Sox. Yeah, Cammy and I were out for dinner. And the meal wasn't going very quickly. And I was not in a very good mood. I'm like, I'm going to leave here pretty quick. And she's like, we got to finish. And I'm like, they got a doggy bag or something. Let's move it along. I would say I wasn't the best date.
No.
And the crazy part, guys, and I guess this is the only way I really relate to, like, Leaf fans or Canadiens fans, is because I don't cheer for my work. I just work. You know, I don't care who wins a hockey game. It doesn't matter to me. I don't think of it the same way. I was nervous all day. I mean, I'd been a Red Sox fan since 1975. And in 1986, I was certain that it was all over. You know, there was two out in the ninth and against the Mets, and then three straight singles, a wild pitch, a base hit, a ball up the line, and it's into Game 7. I was certain that was it. I didn't realize it was going to be 18 more years, right? And so I was nervous. I'm like, what if they blow this one too? Because it's easy to say looking back, oh, I had confidence, but they've lost every other year. Why would they win now? Except they did.
Wait, Ray, what happened in 1975 that you became a Red Sox fan?
I was a Boston Bruins fan. Bobby Orr was and is my idol. I love the Bruins. And then around that time, the Boston Celtics were great. And so that was Dave Cowens and John Havlicek. And so I became a Celtics guy too. And then I started to play baseball more seriously. And in 1975, I was playing all the time. And the Red Sox had these two rookies that came in, Fred Lynn and Jim Rice. And Jim Rice, without question, was my favorite baseball player of all time. Loved the way he played. From 1946, I believe, until Jim Rice retired, they had three left fielders in Boston.
Uh-huh.
Ted Williams, Carl Yastrzemski, and Jim Rice. And my oldest son's middle name is James, and it was because of Jim Rice. So that's how I became a Red Sox guy.
That was a Carlton Fisk
waving
the right, Ray? That was that series, right?
I want to say that was the first time I stayed up past 10 o'clock, you know, like on a school night. And they got in the, I think it was in the 10th, George Foster threw out Denny Doyle at home plate. And the game continued on. So that was a double play that, you know, it was a fly ball with one out, short field and left. It was over by the foul line, and Foster grabbed it, threw to Johnny Bench. And there was a great story about that game and about the broadcast of that game. And since we're all in this business, it is one of the most fascinating reads. It was all kind of happenstance the way it happened, the way the announcers were in the places they were, because they just had two-man booths. And they, after I think about the eighth inning, whoever was doing color went downstairs to do the interviews. And somebody else came in to finish the color analyst spot. It's an amazing read. Like that shot that they got was on of Fisk was on a locked off camera. And it was almost by accident that they got one of the greatest shots in World Series history.
Yeah, pretty amazing. Pretty amazing.
So, the Yankees win in 04 for you, Ray. We'll get into hockey here in a minute, I promise. But the win over the Yankees in 04 was so dramatic because the Sox are down 3-0. They storm back.
I can tell you. Did the World Series... Sorry, Scotty. Scotty, I will tell you. Cammy and I were eating sushi. I look up, and Dave Roberts steals that base.
Uh-huh.
In game four.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, well, maybe they'll win a game. Because by this time, I'm like, again, 3-0, my brother's calling me and he's giving me all kinds of crap. Like in 1978, when the Red Sox were up 14.5 games in July, that was a torturous 2 months because it kept getting closer and closer. And you just knew somehow those rotten Yankees were going to come back. And they did.
Yeah, well, and I think you guys had lost game three of that Yankees series, like 19-8 or something. So,
oh, crushed.
Yeah, just crushed. Destroyed. So, but was the World Series against St. Louis anticlimactic? Because you swept them, right? So by the time game four rolled around, you must have been like, geez, this is unbelievable.
The only thing I was waiting for, honestly, at 3-0, you're like, they can't lose now. But there were so many places they could have lost. Like that Yankee series, three times that series should have been over, and it just wasn't. And there was some, you know, some great heroics. I mean, that was really the time that, that Curt Schilling's legend was built, and you know they ended up going ahead and against the hated rivals to come back and to, you know, to steal a series that shouldn't have happened. And so by the end, I mean when they're flipping the ball to first base, for you know, that seemed like the series was over before it was.
Yeah, well, pretty special when your favorite team wins, especially when it snaps a curse. I can vouch for that, 2016 with the Cubs, and man, was that ever a ride.
Well, somebody, by the way, last point, somebody said that the only way that this would have been more perfect is if the Red Sox and the Cubs had played against each other and nobody won.
Yeah, nobody, exactly. Yeah, just keep playing. Game 8, Game 9, can't declare a winner here. It'll never end. What does it feel like, Ray, when you are as red hot as James Van Riemsdyk is right now as a goal scorer?
Oh, you can't wait to get out there. Every time you go on the ice, you feel like something's going to happen. And the you know, the 180 degrees from that is there are plenty of nights you feel like, man, the puck never comes near me. I'm just out here for a public skate. Like, I never get to touch the puck. Now Van Riemsdyk goes on the ice. He gets it all the time. You can't wait to get it the next time. Like the goal he scored, the second one last night. He gets that pass in the slot. And as I said, I don't know where the Buffalo guys went. But you never get that kind of time. He took the pass from Polak. He turned around, and I think he thought he had to shoot it right away. But then he took two more strides and shot it. The crazy part of that was, and this is the part I mean about thinking you're going to score every time you get on the ice, he came on the ice for the goalie. Like everybody else had been doing all the work out there. He shows up on the ice. I think he was there probably 5 seconds. And then turns around and, oh, would you look at this? I'll move in two more strides, and boom, it's in the net. It's the most awesome feeling.
Yeah, and then in the second period, I mean, he's right up in front of the net there. And Mitch Marner, who is in fuego himself, setting everything up, finds Van Riemsdyk right in front of the crease, and he just flips it right across to Tyler Bozak on that power play. Boom. Put it home. Again, the puck finding you.
Puck finds you. You know where the next play is. You know where the traffic is. It just feels right. I got to tell you, I mean, maybe this is nitpicking, but they're up 2 goals with 3.5 minutes left. I thought he should have been on the ice. Like, what are the chances a player is going to get to score back-to-back hat trick?
Come on, and Ray. Maybe, you know the coach.
I do know the coach.
You think Mike would put him out there for that kind of situation?
Well obviously not.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I'm not the coach. I would have had him out there.
Yeah, I'm with you, Ray. And, you know, you saw what Paul Maurice did last week with Patrick Laine to get the hat trick, you know, the empty netter. Hey, I'm with you. I mean, back-to-back hat tricks, it's a rare occurrence.
Now, I know they're in a different spot, but Ottawa was playing on Tuesday, I guess it was, in Florida, and PRV had 2 goals. He was exhausted, and he tried to come off the ice, and they pushed him back on the ice. And I said in the game, this kid's going to have to learn how to cheat for the empty net here. He's playing too responsibly. Like, they were up by a couple of goals. Like, Van Riemsdyk's a good player. He's not going to cheat to put you in a bad spot. They could have played for 3 hours last night, and Buffalo wasn't going to get 2 more goals. Not a chance. I just thought that was just a simple time. Not that clearly he doesn't care about building favor with his team, but I think it does kind of matter. Now, it might not matter, and they might stampede to a Stanley Cup, and James Van Riemsdyk might sign in Toronto. Or you might get to July, and he goes, you know what, I'm tired of playing 15 and a half minutes a game. And, oh, yeah, I remember that night when I could have had back-to-back hat tricks and I didn't get on the ice. Don't think it doesn't matter, because it all goes into the hopper about, do I like it here? Do I like my role? Do I like where the team is going? Do I like the money they're offering? Do I like the term I'm offering? It all goes in together. And not that you have to buy favor, but I thought last night was an easy one. And maybe that's nitpicking, but I thought it was an easy one.
No, I agree with you. I mean, Tyson Nash down in Arizona just told the story about how Joel Quenneville got him his bonus. And Joel's legendary for coming down at the end of the near the end of the season to find out what everybody's bonuses were and trying to find a way to make sure they could get their bonuses. So
now,
it does
I wasn't
matter.
In on the story. How the hell did Nasher get a bonus?
Yeah, well...
What was that for? 173 dumps off the glass?
Yeah, well, it had to be for some type of clearing or something like that, right?
but Joel, so I can tell you a quick story about Joel. Is when he was coaching in St. Louis, I was in Los Angeles, and we were playing a game, and Noodles was playing. Noodles was actually in goal for St. Louis, and I forget the two players, Scotty Young. Oh, it was Pavel Demitra and Scotty Young. And they both had a bonus. They needed one more point each. And the net was empty. And Demitra went down. Joel had them on the ice at the end of the game, you know, clearly to go for the empty net because they were up by a couple. And Demitra got it, passed it across to Young. He had a wide open net. And we had just called Yaroslav Modry up from the minors. And Young goes to shoot it, and Mo makes this sliding, diving, unbelievable block. And our whole bench was like, no! Like, it was the last game of the year. Like, poor Mo, he's just trying to do the right thing. Everybody else but him knew that this bonus was happening. And he blocked, and as it turned out, the Blues ended up giving Demitra and Young half of their bonus.
Hmm.
Even though they didn't get it, they fell 1 point short.
Talking about making guys happy. Or at least going half the distance fulfill. Yeah. I mean, before we get you out of here, Ray, a thought on JVR and what the Leafs do. Is it a lock that he walks? Because I always go back and forth in my mind on this, which is the one thing that hasn't happened with the Leafs yet, because they haven't really, at this point, had to encounter it, is they haven't gotten locked into one of those 7 or 8 year contracts with a UFA who's going to spend most of that contract on the other side of 30, and you're left kind of going, geez, you know, That's a tough cap hit. Like a Lucic in Edmonton, for example, and I always pick on him, but that's the one that comes to mind. Is there a way he, in your mind, he fits in terms of term and dollar, or is it a lock that he's just out the door?
Well, I guess, Scotty, it depends on what else is sitting out there. Now, if somebody offers him 7 years at $7 million,
goodbye.
Then I think he's out the door. But if he doesn't have that type of offer, and I think those offers are going to be more and more difficult to come by, slowly management seems to be coming to their senses about offering somebody that long a contract, in particular at the age that we're talking about. Now, it only takes one team to offer him, and then Toronto's got a problem. Like the way I'm looking at this, and maybe I've got this a little wrong, but I see there is a way that they can keep Van Riemsdyk. And if I were Toronto, I'd want to, because I think he's a really good player who fulfills, you know, a very valuable role. He's shown that he can be productive wherever you put him in the lineup. He doesn't need a whole bunch of minutes to do it. So if you look at Bozak and Komarov, I think between the two of them, they make $7.2 million. So they're off the books next year in my world. So you let them walk, and there's $7.2 million that's available. If Van Riemsdyk's at 4.5, if you can get him at 6.5, that's only two of the 7.2. And so now you've got $5.2 million to look after William Nylander, who's an RFA, and address potentially replacing Bozak and or Komarov, or whether you think you've got enough from the American League to at least start the season and see what you have. So I think it can be done.
But,
and so if you just play that out a little bit, and Jonas would know this, because you know Jonas would have. I would say you and Masters would know this by extending out the contracts. The next year is the second year of the big money to Marlowe, and then technically that third year they can do just about anything they want with it. Hainsey would be off the books. Gardner's contract's up, so you'd have a decision to make there. Like, there is some flexibility with the Leafs for the next little bit before they get into the real big money of Marner and Matthews.
All right, Ray, we know you got to rock and roll. We'll pick this conversation up without you. Great to chat. Hazy will be back on Monday, provided he's allowed back across the border.
Well, we'll hope so. And by the way, before I go, Jonas, just so you know, Chris Cuthbert and I were having dinner with Masters yesterday, and I think there's an appeal that you guys could make based on one of your answers.
From last?
Yes, from your second defeat.
Interesting.
And if not, Cuthbert and I are prepared to tackle those two knuckleheads in one of these contests.
Did Mark make you aware of this? Can I ask that?
Masters was griping about it on my show to me yesterday.
Yeah, he's a little. He says, I don't want to come off like a complainer, and we're like, it's too late, Mark. You already are complaining. And so he views this. He's not even sure who he would cheer for. And that is a little upsetting.
Well, oh, come on.
The other thing that's
because he views Cuthbert as a mortal enemy because of the information that Mark's wife was flying in coach and Mark was in business.
Well, the other thing that's weird, Ray, is Masters apparently has been hired by O-Dog to help O-Dog prepare for the next trivia showdown. And I said to Masters, why is the guy who beat you twice hiring you to help him? Shouldn't it be the other way around?
Except, let's be honest. I think the greatest answer was 1856. Was that the year he used? When was the Constitution written?
My favorite was, my buddy's hiking it right now. Machu Picchu's in India. That was the best.
Loved I think it. That football helmet is too tight on him, and I don't think Masters could possibly help him.
All right, pal. It was a blast as always. We'll do it again soon.
Guys, enjoy your weekend. We'll talk to you.
You bet. Ray Ferraro on Overdrive, brought to you by Valiant Financial. For fast approvals and competitive payment options on heavy equipment from any dealer, visit valiantfinancial.ca. We got to flip the script here and talk Raptors with Jared Greenberg of NBA TV in just a couple minutes. But we'll come back to this a little bit later on in the show and get both of your thoughts. The notion of becoming emotionally attached to players who've had a lot of success for you. You guys were talking yesterday, Jonas, about the Blackhawks. And I think that might have been part of the Ray conversation. I was in the car at the time I was listening.
No, it was just Noodles.
Okay, but there was some debate about the Seabrook contract and different things.
Mm-hmm.
Decisions get really hard as those players become UFAs in their late 20s off their second contracts looking for their third. And, you know, we're years away from this with the Maple Leafs, but how difficult is it to have to make some of those emotional decisions when guys who have performed at such a high level for you and brought or contributed to bringing a franchise so much success?
Well, it can be bad and good. Like, remember 2013, Grabowski, we can ask Dave Poulin actually about this, did not have, I think, what they thought it was a great playoff series. I don't agree. They bought him out. If I'm not mistaken, it was that summer. I think it was like a few days before they signed Clarkson. So like there can be emotional reactions to what happens in the playoffs, which is dangerous. Like I always think these teams that sign players in the middle of the year, like a player has a good stretch and then they sign the guy for 5 years, that never made any sense to me, because if the player was going through 20 games without a goal, you'd probably be like, we're not signing this guy. Like, I just don't think you should make decisions when you're emotional.
It's real simple. There's a phrase for it. Dispassionate assessment.
Yeah.
And if you don't apply it, you're going to be making mistakes. That's why the New England Patriots don't make mistakes, because that's how Belichick acts and that's how he practices things. I'm not paying somebody for what they did. I'm paying somebody for what they're going to do. You know what? That's how it works. And that's what you got to do. And if you're not disciplined in that area, the mistakes are going to be there for all to see.
We'll pick this back up a little bit later on in the program. Jared Greenberg to talk Raps. Some massive breaking news out of Major League Baseball. Huge contract extension for Jose Altuve with Houston. And some Blue Jays news as well. Scott MacArthur, Craig Button, Jonas Siegel. It's Overdrive on your Friday, TSN 1050, the TSN Go app. Well, the Raps just continue to roll, going into Indiana last night and beating the Pacers 106-99. And by the way, Indiana these days, no slouch. They were one of the hotter teams in the NBA overall. They've jumped over Cleveland for the time being for third seed in the Eastern Conference. And the Raps are right back home and host the Dallas Mavericks tonight, one of the lesser teams in the Western Conference, I believe.
Lesser teams?
I believe
they're terrible.
I believe actually, they're higher up. They've jumped a couple of teams in the standings since.
I don't care who they jumped. They're still terrible.
They're terrible. Well, they've acknowledged that they.
It's like trying to tell me the bottom seven teams in the league, or they're all terrible.
I believe Mark Cuban paid a $600,000 fine for saying, "Hey, you know what? We've been tanking the last year and a half or two." But Dallas in tonight for their lone visit. Jared Greenberg of NBA TV is here. Jared, this Raptors team, I think, is finally starting to get the notoriety and recognition it deserves on both sides of the border. I even feel that there's a kind of a pickup here in the city of Toronto. People are talking about this team, for lack of a better way to put it, around the water cooler. Do you like the composition of this group? The idea that while DeRozan may be a superstar in this league, he's not at the LeBron level, that this team, as it's comprised, including its stellar bench, is strong enough to get through the Eastern Conference?
I need a question answered first. Well, when's the last time you guys stood around a water cooler?
I said for lack of a better phrase. But you're right. I don't think I've ever stood around a water cooler.
Right. Matter of fact, I can't remember the last time that I went to go get water from a water cooler and didn't get it from either like a bottle or a sort of tap service or something, you know.
We've got water coolers here at work. You just have to know where to find them. But you're right. I've never stood around a water cooler beyond the time it has taken to fill the cup with water.
But if I were to go stand around a water cooler right now, and chat with people about Toronto Raptor basketball. I would say I love the composition of this team. And I think timing is everything, guys. I think that listen, the Raptors are taking care of business, and they're doing it in a year when LeBron seems to be at his most vulnerable since the first time he was with Cleveland before he left to go to Miami. And that's no knock against the Raptors. They're doing their part. And, you know, for Raptor fans who are disappointed that maybe they don't, you know, it's always interesting to me that Raptor fans seem to be upset about not getting enough notoriety in places they can't hear that notoriety. But they want everybody talking about him. And I understand the respect factor, and that's the pride factor of being a fan. But the thing for the Raptors that I think, you know, and the big fan base that you guys have is that once you start winning these playoff games and these playoff series, believe me, you're going to get it. You know, and I think that's the cool thing about professional sports is that you earn, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, subjective respect. It's going to be earned by this team who, you know, now they've set the bar, and that's what's important here is that you're the number one seed, and it's not like a situation necessarily like Boston last year where clearly Cleveland just let their foot off the gas pedal and said, you know what, Boston, you can go ahead and take that one seed. That could be yours. We know we can come out of the East no matter what seed we are. This year, Cleveland has no control of that. I mean, the Raptors are the best team in the Eastern Conference, no question, in the regular season. But now with that comes expectation. And it's not just about respect or notoriety or how much people are talking about you. You're the number one seed, and, you know, you threaten to win 60 games. Well, you darn better at least reach the conference finals, if not better, right? And I think that this team is capable. You know, some of the things that I would have been a bit hesitant about, to me, almost feels like it's been taken care of. You know, I'm wondering if some of these young guys who have never been in these big moments before can handle that. But I think the way that Dwayne Casey has put these guys in different spots and the way they've won games of late, you know, I look at last night in Indiana, look last week to how they had to beat an Orlando team that's really bad. I just like how they're finding ways to win games that they're supposed to win. And it seems kind of obvious to say that, but in today's NBA, it's very rare to find teams that are able just to take care of the business they're supposed to take care of and then really be able to focus in on and come up with signature wins like the Raptors did last week, knocking off the Rockets.
So, Jared, you know, all the talk seems to be around LeBron, you know, the consecutive visits to the NBA Finals and everything. But, you know, watching the Cleveland Cavaliers, is really the fear of LeBron just based on the history and not the present state of the team?
Yes, but I will also say this. I think you're, you know, almost 100% spot on with that. But it's also LeBron, right? Like, we're not talking about the guy who's, you know, just a generational talent. I mean, you know, as long as they play basketball on this planet, within the first chapter of that story, we will be talking about LeBron James, right? Like, so it's not like it's undeserved. And we've seen him do magical things before. And I'm not saying it's going to happen this year, but I think there's also this aspect of people wanting to be right about predictions. You know, these days, you know, I told you so. See, I predicted this. And it's easy right now for people still to say, all right, well, the Cavs got all these new pieces. They don't seem to be winning games against good teams. And LeBron can't keep this up by himself. They don't have another star. But you know what? It's still LeBron James. So I want to be right.
Well,
the Raptors are a better team. But here, whether we want to say LeBron has the pieces around him or not, I don't think he does. But ultimately, the Raptors have to go and prove it, right? Somebody has to go knock him off.
Yeah. Well, Jared, I was watching the Cavs-Blazers game last night, and there was just one position where he just decides he's going to score, and he scores. But watching them, it really doesn't feel like they're going to be able to get over not having that second guy who can score himself, like not having Kyrie. Even if you get Kevin Love back at some point here soon, do you feel like that's going to be the fatal flaw, whether they get to the NBA Finals or not, that they're going to just miss Kyrie?
Oh, sure. Without question. I mean, you know, that was my biggest concern coming into this year. Now I'd say, listen, all right, the Cavs got to get over this. And what I've been saying since the moment they traded Kyrie, and I took this, you know, from what Ty Lue said, the coach of the Cavs over the summer, is they got to go and realize the talent they have in Kevin Love. And obviously he needs to get healthy first, right? He needs to get back onto the court, make sure his hand's okay, prove that he can, you know, get back in game shape, and for their sake, do it with enough games before the playoffs start. But once he establishes that, they've got to go back, and I don't know if it needs to be a replica of Kevin Love in Minnesota, where we were putting him in the conversation for one of the two or three best power forwards in this league, but they need to trust him, and LeBron needs to trust Kevin Love to go be a dynamic scorer and one of the best rebounders in this league. And listen, whatever you think of Kevin Love, he is their best option because it's a known commodity. Maybe one day down the road, Rodney Hill or Jordan Clarkson are become a better basketball player. But right now, you've got Kevin Love, who's an NBA champion, who's been through this, and there's only a couple of other guys in that locker room that could say they've been through this with LeBron the last few years. And quite frankly, I think their ceiling is way higher trying out Kevin Love as their number two guy on a regular basis rather than figuring out if it can be Rodney Hill or George Hill or Larry Nance or Jordan Clarkson.
With Jared Greenberg of NBA TV, this is Overdrive on TSN 1050.
Well, Jared, just going back to, you know, the other team in the East that you kind of look at and say they could potentially be the team that gets the NBA Finals, what's your confidence level now in the Celtics given, you know, Marcus Smart being out, Kyrie being banged up, as compared to what you might have thought going into the year?
Well, you know, going into the year, I thought very highly of them. Obviously, 5 minutes into the season, it all changed with a guy like Gordon Hayward, who I still think people, you know, around North America don't really have a great grasp on how great of a player Gordon Hayward is. And it'll be exciting to get him back healthy and see him on the court next year. But, you know, this team, like I was talking about with the Raptors, you know, so many guys on a different – each night it seems like there's a different younger player on the Raptors that – either gets asked to step up or just does step up and performs, and you don't need that same performance the next night. The thing with the Celtics now is that, okay, Kyrie can be spectacular, but then you need a Jaylen Brown or a Jason Tatum to also be great. And to ask a guy in their first or second year to do that in moments they haven't really been in, and listen, Jaylen Brown was in the playoffs last year, but not nearly in the role that he's going to be asked to play this year. And by the way, he's got to get healthy as well. I don't know if you guys saw that gruesome fall he took a couple weeks back. It was just disgusting, and he's still dealing with concussion-like symptoms. But, you know, they are asking a lot of guys to step up into roles that I think the Celtics saw these guys growing into in 3 or 4 years down the road. But because they've been so successful now, they need these guys to hurry up and do it with all the injuries they're dealing with. I think that a lot of the versatility has been stripped away from the Celtics with all these injuries. Ultimately, I think they'll still be a danger because they've got Kyrie and guys who have been through it. And Brad Stevens is arguably one of the two or three best coaches in the game, one of the best in-game adjustment guys. But ultimately, I think that these injuries are going to come back and bite them. And for them, they can play the long game here because they got everybody coming back next year. Maybe Marcus Smart not because his contract is up.
Jared, when Klay Thompson went down in Golden State the other day, it got me to thinking, because I think we're all working off the assumption that the Warriors and Rockets will meet in the Western Final. What is the circumstance that would put the Rockets over the top? Because with Golden State, Klay goes down, but yeah, there's Steph. Yeah, there's KD. Yeah, there's Draymond. What's the circumstance that puts the Rockets over the top, if there is one?
Right, so this is something I've been talking about. We carried on NBA TV last night, the Rockets and Clippers game, and Matt Bullard, who won a championship with the Rockets, now calls games for Houston, made a comment toward the end of the game. He said he's been speaking to players on the Rockets, and they believe that there's only one team in the league that's capable of beating the Rockets. He gave a very dramatic, pregnant pause and then said, it's the Houston Rockets. We're all thinking he's going to say the Warriors, right? And basically his point was, if the Rockets are at their best, their confidence level is they can't be beat. Now, that's the way they should feel. I have no problem with that. I just feel if everyone's healthy and everyone plays their A game, right, if there is true perfection over a 7-game series by both teams in every single game, I think the Warriors come out with 4 of the wins. I just think their experience factor, plus they have more great players, right? Like, you can talk about depth all you want, and the Raptors have great depth that we've been talking about, but if DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry aren't great, right, the Raptors are not going to have that success. And the thing with the Rockets is they've got great depth, they've got incredible versatility, they've got guys that can do different things that really can mess with the Warriors. But ultimately, they need Chris Paul and James Harden more times than not to be really, really great. But the one thing that I'm going to be interested to watch here with the Rockets down the stretch is how good they've been defensively, because Mike D'Antoni has trusted Jeff Bezdilek as defensive coordinator to install this defense with defensive-minded players that are on the court in big-time scenarios. Is Mike D'Antoni going to trust his squad enough to keep those players, P.J. Tucker, who you guys saw in Toronto, Luke Bahamute, is he going to keep those guys on the court when the game's at its best, when Mike D'Antoni traditionally says, you know what, screw defense, we'll just go outscore you? Because if that's the way you're going to try and beat the Warriors, typically you're going to lose. And I would like to see Mike D'Antoni stick with what got him to this point to be the number one seed. And if he could ride that out, then that'll make this one interesting.
Great stuff, Jared, as always. Really appreciate it. Let's catch up again soon.
You got it, guys. Thanks so much.
Jared Greenberg, heading back to the water cooler. Jared, of course, of NBA TV. Hour number three of Overdrive coming up. Our good buddy Dave Poulin will join us in studio, and we'll get to Friday's five-pack, St. Patrick's Day weekend. Our top five Pats, or Patricks, however it is you want to play it out. I've got mine. Jonas and Craig have theirs. We'll get to it. Overdrive, TSN 1050, the TSN Go app. So dinner's on Jose Altuve, boys. 5 years, $151 million. I love it. Because I always wondered, would the Houston Astros be able to keep that core together? I know Correa's still a kid. He's got a number of years of control left before he makes huge cake. George Springer. But they're showing Altuve the love, and he absolutely deserves it. This guy's one of the best players in the game. And at like 5'5", 5'6", a prime example of somebody who's overcome the odds.
Odds of what?
Well, he's 5'5", 5'6", Craig.
What does height have to do with it?
Doesn't measure heart?
Doesn't measure bat speed or eye-hand coordination.
But you just don't see
a lot of examples.
I totally agree. I totally agree. But, you know, that's why I always say, evaluate the player before you start evaluating the height and the weight.
I feel like this is like something that bothers you about the way hockey has been scouted forever.
Hey, listen, like you know, the easiest thing for me to do is when I go and I do my rankings and I look at the smaller player and I go, yeah, that guy, I think that guy's going to be a really good player, because history shows you that it's the smaller player that always turns out.
Yeah, and we're seeing more defensemen are.
Yeah, because of the way the game is being played, right? Yeah.
I remember asking John Gibbons.
And you're right, Jonas, it is. It bugs me. Like people going, yeah, but what about his height? And then the most overused phrase, he's going to have to get stronger. Oh, really? Well, how about that for insight?
17-year-old
kid has to get stronger. Really? Really? Come on. That's the best you got?
Doesn't have his man strength yet. I remember asking John Gibbons a few years ago, I said, Mark Burley today is an 18-year-old high school kid, or he's a 21-year-old college kid, and he's in the draft. Does anybody take him? Because he's throwing 85 miles an hour, right? And Gibby looked at me and said, well, geez, I hope so. But
everybody gets caught up in the flash and the dash.
The radar gun, man, in baseball.
Tyler Bozak dominated the BCHL. And I remember watching him, and I'm going, like, somebody should just draft him late in the draft. And if he never turns out, who cares? He's going to college. If he never turns out, who cares? You know, you're drafting this immensely talented player. 3 years later, he's grown, he's big, and there's a free agent frenzy for Tyler Bozak. Yep. Like, if you went and watched him in the BCHL, he was a dominant player. Dominant.
But, and here he is.
Oh, my Lord, he's 5'7". Okay. Okay. I think I'll check out on just, that note.
Just really too bad when you get to the end of the hour and Craig's just winding up.
Jonas got me fired up.
There you go. We'll get to hour number three or get our buddy Pooley into studio. Dave Poulin will join us, and we'll bring you some news out of the Blue Jays. A minor leaguer who isn't as well known as some of their top minor leaguers getting busted for PED use. We'll deal with all of it. Hour number three of Overdrive, TSN 1050.